Well, I'd like to just talk rapidly for about an hour, and we can have maybe a half an hour or so discussion if you find there is enough to discuss. I've chosen the general theories that I want to talk about for a reason that may surprise you. That is, almost no account of any theory of love can leave out Plato, and I wanted at least one philosopher. Then I wanted to include some literary figures, one prose writer, the novelist Stendhal, and then a poet, Rilke, also because the theories are, well, similar in some respects, very, very different in others, and then finally a psychologist or pseudo-psychologist, depending on your point of view, Freud. Love takes many forms, masochism for one, like those who come to talks in the middle of the afternoon. It is a dangerous subject, even more dangerous than speaking about sex. That is, I think we can see, if we look at the theories, well, not just at these, but many others that might have been chosen, two in particular that come to mind, Spinoza's, which is a theory so complex and difficult to talk about except at a very complicated level without falsifying. That's one reason I'm not doing it. It's one of the most important of all theories. Or Ortega y Gasset's theory, the most recent, I suppose, in his little book on love. But whether it's Spinoza or Plato or Freud or whoever talking about the subject, the danger is that you give yourself away and you say more about yourself than the subject. Perhaps I can avoid that by talking about other people's views rather than my own, or sneaking them in through the disguise, as Freud might suggest. We have to make a number of distinctions right at the first in order to get any adequate picture of whether a theory is accounting for the data and the problems. First, of course, we have to distinguish something that Rilke is very good at distinguishing, the condition of loving from that of being loved. Many of our theories, in particular a theory like Stendhal's, concentrate not exclusively, but in great part on the problem of loving. And indeed, that's where most theories of love begin. They almost never begin by examining the sad condition of the victim of this passion. Rilke does, and his theory is developed out of such consideration. Another thing that has to be noted and kept clear all the way along, and is rarely kept clear in most theories of love, and at least not all the time, and that is whether or not our theory is a descriptive one, that is, a description of love, or whether it is what love ought to be. A theory, for example, which I'm not talking about, Ortega's, begins with a series of descriptions, including a long piece on Stendhal's theory, which he dislikes intensely, describing what other people have not only thought about love, but various ways people have said they fell in love. And Ortega says, they didn't fall in love, they just thought they were falling in love, this isn't love, and so on. And it turns out in Ortega's theory that love is a talent which only a few people possess. If you know Ortega, that's exactly what you would expect. He is a resolute, fanatical elitist. Even in love, only a few people ever have had that experience. So there you have clearly what love ought to be. And love is there was defined in such rarefied terms that only a few people ever make it. Now the shift from a description, presumably an account, as Freud at least presumes to give us, to a normative thing is very frequent, very dangerous, in the sense that it causes all kinds of confusion, and indeed this is a field in which love assumes so many guises that it is very tempting to say, well, this isn't really love, but this is. And so you have to decide really what you're going to do from the first, whether you're going to have a normative theory. Finally, you have to notice that most theories of love are not just theories of love. They are already involved in huge philosophical, metaphysical, usually, and often religious situation, so that they are not independent theories. They are busy serving something or other. This is one reason why I'm leaving out the Christian doctrines of love, because it is so much a part of a huge system that you have to describe that in detail before you can really come to grips with the others. Now, the Greeks, as you doubtless know, had observed what I think we all observe, three different kinds of love that are popularly distinguished almost everywhere. The Greeks, three words for those. The first, eros, meaning what the Greeks would call desirous love, sexual love. Philia, which is embedded in the word philosophy, lover of wisdom. But that word, of course, distinguished clearly from eros as a kind of family condition. Philia is more brotherly love, the love between friends. It doesn't involve sexuality, except in odd cases. It's possible, for example, for men and women to have sisterly feelings toward one another. It would fall into that kind of category fraternal or sororal, as we must now add, love. And agape, which is familiar to us, of course, through the Christian use of that Greek term, agape as it's sometimes pronounced, devotion, as in the expression, I just love geometry. I don't just eros geometry, and I don't philia it. I presume, though, a lover of wisdom, you see, is a philosopher. Aristotle used the expression later to describe certain Platonists as friends of the forms, he used the word philia, friends. Devotion is what's suggested, really, almost worship, so that if you said you loved a particular author, you might indeed be using it in that sense. If I said, I just love Stanley Elkin, I could mean it both of the latter two ways, as a friend of the author and as a lover or devoted person about his work. Now, before we examine the four theories, let's make a map of the terrain. That is, the kinds of things that generally have to be touched on if you're going to give an adequate account. I have noted down 11. I'm sure there could be 16, 32, 45, and so on. And time simply prevents going on. But I think that these are all important elements. A full-fledged theory ought to say something about all of them, most theories do not. Frequently we can deduce what they might say or would have to say about them. The first, of course, is, and the source of the most confusion in all of the theoretical accounts, is what might be called the faculty dimension. If we go back again to the Greek philosophers, Plato and Socrates, who divided the soul into three parts, reason, passion, and desire. What is love? What area of the soul is love attached to? Is love basically a desire? Is it basically a feeling? Or is it a cognition of some sort and connected with reason? Oftentimes, a theory will start out in one area and slip unbeknownst into another. The confusion of lust on the one hand, which is usually the strong, physical, desiring eros that the Greeks were primarily concerned with when they talked about love or theories of love, is often then confused with or connected with the more sentiment oriented theories, the passion theories of the Romantics, in particular Stendhal is a beautiful example of these, in which case love becomes a passion. It is perfectly possible, of course, to mix the two, to have one as in a sense the basement for the other, it is also possible to say that you can be in love passionately without or apart from desire. So there's a first area then we have to decide upon is what we're going to do. The rational side is not as frequently confused, but it is there. And in there, basically, we speak, for example, or they speak in the Bible, I should not say we, they speak in the Bible of carnal knowing. There is a use of the word know, which it may, of course, not apply so much to rational procedures as simply to experience, knowledge by experience, rather than knowledge by acquaintance and so on. Description, I mean, rather than acquaintance. The second dimension is what might be called the dynamic dimension. Is love, that is to say, principally active, or is it principally passive? And this, these words can be twisted around, of course. For someone like Spinoza, the kind of love which exhibits a great deal of activity, writing billy-doos and sending flowers and playing the banjo and so forth, whatever, all kinds of activities, paying court to, even committing suicide because of, all those would be, in his terminology, passive. That's a passive emotion. Why? Because you are in its grip. It has you. That's always, for Spinoza, bad. You are in what he calls human bondage, a bondage to human passions. So the problem for Spinoza is to change your love from something he calls passive to something active. But of course, active love for him is contemplative, detached. So we have to worry about the way these words flip-flop, right? So that we don't get confused. And each theory then will concentrate on one side or other, activity, passivity, or if they're value-oriented, like ought, they'll start out by saying, people usually are this way, but they ought to be this way. Transform the thing. And we'll see, too, that for Freud, this is a very important element in the transformational process of love as you move from passive love to active and so on. In each case, we have to watch to see what the theory means by these terms. The next dimension is the distance or identity. That is love going to be conceived as fundamentally a desire for, merging, or a feeling for, merging, or a thought about? There's a mysticism and in certain theories of knowledge, it's an identity of the knower and the known, and so on. Is it going to be a sense of merging and identity, or absorption, union, or is it going to be distance, detachment, separation, and so on? Two ambiguities of the word know play their part here. Some theories hold that in order to know something, you have to be it. No. And frequently in arguments, as I recently had a rather noisy one in Washington, a woman who was shouting at me saying, you can't know what it is to be black and lesbian, and so on, and I, you know, unless you are black and lesbian. So you have to be one in order to know one. The other view, of course, is that Americans can't possibly know what Americans are like. It takes a Frenchman. And that is, you have to be somebody else. You have to be outside. Right? This kind of argument occurs frequently in cultural relativity arguments, and the confusion of the two kinds of no, of course, is very, very important. So in these theories, we're going to have Rilkean doctrine, detachment. Indeed, it's best hardly even to know one another, love by letter. In other theories, of course, it's a union of the two bodies, souls, or whatever level. Then there's the terms of the relationship, another dimension. There are some people who will hold that love is intentional in the technical philosophical term. That is, it intends an object. It is impossible, in fact, to have a love without a subject and an object. Others will say there are other elements involved in a relationship, that it is always a ménage à trois, at least, of other elements and the like. If, of course, love is always has an object, then is self-love possible? If self-love is possible, is it because you're dividing and one part of you is loving the other part? Valérie, who is very much interested in the recession of self-consciousness, being conscious of its self-consciousness, which is, and so on, said it would be very hard to be a real narcissist if love had to have an object in the real sense, because you would always be leaving out a part of yourself, the part that was loving the other part but was not being loved. You know, there's a problem. Anyway, there's that kind of thing. Is there selfless love? A love that doesn't exactly have a subject. I mean, and so on. Is it possible, another question that arises in this condition, is it possible to be in love with love? I'm not in love with you, dear. I'm in love with loving you, dear. And so on, right? So there's all of those elements that have to be considered. Then there's, in terms of not only a desire and emotion and reason or whatever, there are the factors of pleasure and pain, the hedonistic element, which Freud, of course, makes paramount. Or, as we translate that into Spinoza, happiness or unhappiness. Because for Spinoza, certainly, love has to do with a condition of happiness, and hate a condition of unhappiness or sadness. That is to say, love a desire to give pleasure or to receive pleasure? Is it possible that love is painful? Ortega points out that people who think, like Spinoza, that love has to do with happiness or really haven't been observing how miserable being in love is, that it is a condition, basically, of pain, and so on. I think he misreads Spinoza there, because I don't think Spinoza makes that mistake. I think he knows perfectly well how painful that kind of love is, and that's why he recommends another kind. Love a source, then, of happiness or unhappiness? What is the relation, in short, of love and hedonism in some general sense? Then there's, of course, the temporal character. Again, Ortega's very good on this side of it, pointing that it is a very crucial factor. That is your theory of love about momentary things, week-long things, month-long things, forever things? Is it, in short, possible to fall in love while knowing at the time you're falling in love that this is only going to be a weekend? Or do you always fall in love with the idea, even though it may only be a weekend, that it's forever? In other words, is there a temporal element to falling in love that we say, you know, I'm lost, I'm gone forever, and so on, or not? Is love a long-term condition? Comparatively continuous. Now again, to the degree you see it's an appetite, it could be continuous only as a possibility. For example, just having had lunch, I am not hungry. But I know that I will be hungry by evening. So I can say, ah, my love, I'm not hungry today, but tomorrow I will be. It always returns. Right? Now, in that sense, you could have a continuous intermittence, right, like hunger is. Or you could have something that really is discontinuous. And of course, while hunger continues, and you may in fact go on your whole life loving grapefruit for breakfast, usually you don't go on loving the same spouse for breakfast. So there's this question about the eternity of the feeling. And the condition, and whether it's felt one way or another. The conceptual relations are important. That's another dimension. That is, what is the connection of love with other terms, ideas, states. With hate, for instance, Freud has very interesting things to say about this. For some theories, love and hate are in fact indistinguishable, connected. I said at the conceptual level, it may be, of course, at the actual level. It may be that to love somebody, you also have to hate them a good deal, or even in a Manichaean theory where good and evil are always equal, to love somebody a whole lot, you have to hate them just about the same amount. Indeed, there is a nice theory that the amount of love anyone has is limited. You just have so much. So if you're loving somebody X that much, you can't love somebody else except what you have left over. And the same is true for the hate relation. Now, just as some people think that good and evil are correlative terms, so that you can't define or understand one term without reference to the other. And then they make the mistake of inferring from this that if the terms are correlative, the objects of the terms must also be correlative. It's often a frequent argument to show the good, and it must be, you can't blame God for evil because he had to make evil, otherwise there wouldn't be any good. Now that might be true, but really you can't make the jump from the condition of the language to the condition described or referred to by the language. But in many cases then of talking about love, there are some people who say, well, you, in order to have love, you have to have hate. Either as an idea to understand what love is, or as an actual condition. So there are those elements, and there are many other conceptual things. One of the things that Stendhal, of course, points out is that love is closely connected, absolutely intimately connected to ideas of reality and appearance, whether things are real or whether they're appearance. In Stendhal's theories, we'll see, you cannot fall in love with reality, only with fiction, even his fiction. Then there's, of course, the whole notion of values. A love is, by definition, the assertion somewhere of a positive value. Now, it isn't clear, you see, whether it's the loving that's the positive thing. Gee, it's great to be in love. No, it's awful to be in love. But whatever, somewhere there is the assertion of positive value. Is this a value, again, basically for the subject? If I say, I just love cream of wheat, which is only an example. If I say I just love cream of wheat, I don't mean I'm worrying about cream of wheat. I take care of my cream of wheat. Bugs never get into it because I keep it in a container very tightly, so forth. It means I eat up cream of wheat. I destroy cream of wheat. So, in a sense, if I say, you see, to somebody, I love you, it may, of course, mean that the value is to me. You're valuable, that is to say, as a satisfaction of my desires. It might be that I am proclaiming an intrinsic value in the object which I have simply had the great wit to observe. See, this is one of the things that Ortega says. As great lovers have the ability to perceive the value in the person. And indeed, for Ortega, you only should love what's worthy of love. And, of course, that means if you love dumb, ugly, inconsiderate, insensitive people, you must be those very things as well. It's a sign. So for Ortega, of course, the things you have around you are signs of your own sensitivity, ability, and the like. This is one of the reasons, of course, that love is, in a sense, a matter that Stendhal sneers at, of good taste. Now, so we have to decide, for example, whether love is fundamentally altruistic, whether it is fundamentally selfish, or there are modes of different kinds. We can have, of course, species. What we have to worry about is that we could have the problem in which you say, yes, that's love. Okay, that's love too. That one, you know, sort of a mindless empiricism which leads you to call anything anybody has ever called love, love. You don't have a theory anymore. Now, that might be the right thing, and maybe the safest and sensible thing to do, but then we wouldn't have any theory, and we love to make theories. Finally, last two dimensions, does and this is one that Rilke explores very much, does love confer a claim on the lover with regard to the beloved? That is, if I love you, what morally as a subject can I claim from you? You can't do that. I love you. Huh? We see that over and over. We hear it all the time. One of the chief reasons for falling in love is, of course, that you can start making claims on somebody. Particularly that you will be hurt. Huh? Mothers wouldn't be able to function without this side, right, of it. And, of course, that conversely, if somebody says to you, I love you, can you say, oh, in that case, lend me $5? You know, what indeed is just because you're loved, do you get any rights, privileges, obligations conferred, or what? Similarly, of course, from the mutuality. If, of course, we have, you see, a view earlier about the relations, that is the number of terms in the relation of love, then, of course, for somebody to say, I love you, X, does that mean that ultimately, for that love to continue, it has to be returned so that it is an interaction or not? Finally, the dimension of intensity. This isn't finally just because it was the last one I thought of, but because in a certain odd way it's one of the most important. By intensity now, what I mean is the degree to which the whole organism, the whole metaphysical organism, that is body, soul, or whatever thing that you involve yourself in with your picture of people, to what extent is the whole being involved in this? Is it just a part of one that's involved? Does it affect everything? And so on and so on. To what intensity then? May love, in the obvious sense, be quiet and calm, or must be passionate and consuming? For Stendhal, it's not possible to be quiet and calm. We do speak of being more or less in love. Now, is love a state or a condition? Do we say, gee, I'm more or less sick? I'm more or less sad? Or, I'm a little bit sad, or I'm a little sick, so forth. Is it a condition that allows of degrees? These things are connected, of course. If we say that it's a matter of degree, then it is harder to say that when you love for all time. I'm a little bit in love for all time. I mean, it doesn't, you know, that kind of problem immediately arises. Okay, well, I'm sure you may have questions about this, but I want to get on to the four in swiftly now. All right, if we start with Plato, the reason for even going over, because most people know Plato, but I think most people have him wrong. That is, the popular theories about love and Platonic love, I think, are hopelessly mistaken. Now, the stress in Plato is on Eros. That is, when Plato's talking, he knows the other kinds of love, but when he's talking about a theory of love that interests him, he's talking about Eros. So his is a theory of sexual love. He cannot be accused of not recognizing the other elements. And they do follow along. But afterward, the principal thing is that love is desire. Now, at the lowest level of love, we can ask a series of questions, and I answer them very quickly for Plato. At the lowest level, what attracts the lover? And the answer, of course, is beauty. But beauty now, in the broadest sense, of virtue. And we have to remind ourselves that for the Greeks, virtue, the word erite, meant manliness. No word, womanliness, for virtue. Manliness, and it generally applied to those kinds of virtue, abilities, skills, which made of a man a protector, a warrior, courageous, fundamentally efficient, and indeed they showed forth on the person. to the degree, again, that you were stressing virtues that had to do with war, with competitive society and skills of the sort, then it showed in the physique, just as we would expect to some extent this to be in football players. You find the announcer constantly saying, but he's only 5'9". How can he be playing in them? And so on. Right? So, in a sense, and again, I'm sure in the casting offices, the dimensions are run over and they say, but she's only this, this, and this. We can't, you know. So, in certain senses, what was thought was that beauty, now, in the broadest sense, was the showing forth of virtue. The showing forth of health, of strength, of abilities to perform in the areas, and indeed for a woman then, to the degree that was carried over, and it certainly was, horses had arete, virtue, so women could certainly have some. And they did, that is to say, depending on what kind of woman you were interested in. If it was the mother of your children, you looked for a woman who, of course, looked like a good child-bearer, who could be smart enough to run household accounts. That was an important aspect, the economics of households and so on, were in the hands mainly of women, and so on. Or, if you were interested in mistresses, of course, it was another kind of quality, but you would look at for beauty. Right? So you might look at a what we would call a peasant type, heavy, big hips, strong, and we say, beautiful. She could pull a plow. And that's exactly what, you know, you want. Right. So, beauty was the physical showing forth, then, of virtue. And that is an idea that runs all the way through Plato, although he modifies it, cleans it up a good deal. So, at the lowest level, what attracts the lover is beauty, virtue, in this sense. And what does this attraction lead to? Well, generally, again, intercourse, sexual relations. At the lowest level, the culmination of this is children, right, progeny. And this will stay in Plato, that is to say, the aim of the lover is birth in beauty. That's the formula, of course, that occurs at the highest level in the Symposium. It is, in fact, ultimately, Eros is, in fact, for Plato, ultimately the desire for immortality. Now, at the bodily level, you attempt to achieve immortality through the love of another body, to produce another body. But, of course, Plato, famous ladder of beauty, begins to alter the objects of Eros. This, of course, is very closely related to this move made by Freud, who, in his formulations, often alters the object. So, of course, then we, in a sense, sublimate. So, of course, virtue soon becomes, as we change, refine our nature of virtue, so that it isn't merely these so-called macho things, but is also, since Socrates is famously ugly, he can hardly go around, but his wisdom, his virtue of soul shines through. So now we're loving different sort of things. And as we do this, the odd thing is that our interest then in mere procreation changes, and we begin to love the mind more. That means, of course, for Greek, we begin to love men more, because men have better minds than women. Right? And sometimes one thinks they don't have any minds at all in some of the elements of Greek theory, though Plato was perhaps the most liberated of the prisoners of Greek thought, in a sense. So we move, of course, from physical to psychological, finally to social, so that we, in effect, love the state, and then love the laws, and love science, and so forth. Now, as we're moving in a very strange way, through heterogeneous categories. That is to say, categories which aren't on the same level of metaphysical level at all. From bodies to souls, then from souls to abstract entities like constitutions, from constitutions to even more abstract entities like laws of physics or some theory of science, but finally the famous forms themselves. As you're moving through that, you're making, of course, very frequently large logical jumps. Plato supposes, however, and this is the reason for those jumps in part, that what then remains when you have even made a metaphysical leap from body to mind, or body to soul, will be the true essence of love, or the object of love, the nature of beauty. So, of course, when we ask ourselves, what are the properties which show forth the physical beauty? One of them is proportion, harmony, health, so forth and so on. Similarly, that applies to the soul, balance, proportion, harmony. It applies to the constitution of the state, order, harmony, and you go on all the way up, so that the thinker who has now taken eros, desirous love, and transformed it, it's still desirous love, but it is now a desire to know the ideas, the great forms, and to bring to birth now in knowledge spiritual children. In particular, of course, the improvement of one's own soul. So in this later view, while you have an object of love, you don't have another person as an object. The people you get rid of very rapidly. And this is a theory we find it repeated in part in Spinoza, very popular among rationalist philosophers, that you move from people to ideas. And the object of true love is ideas. This is, of course, important also in the teacher-student relationship. Education is a form of the highest sort of seduction. To bring beauty to birth in the soul of the student as well as in the soul of the teacher. So the creative act, I think, in Plato is now a image at a higher level of the procreative act. And we have, I think, not only a theory of love in Plato, but we have a theory of creativity. And it's opposed to procreativity. Well, very rapidly, that's so cursory it's terrible, but nevertheless, I have to. Stendhal. We move, of course, from the 4th century to the 18th. We move to a strange century which is also rationalistic, an age of enlightenment, an age of egotism and sentimentality. The Polar's terms are expressed beautifully in Jane Austen's novel, Sense and Sensibility. And Stendhal wrote a book for the happy few, as he pointed out, he only had a few readers, called On Love, which he thought indeed, with a perversity of genius, that it was his greatest work. I only want to touch, it's a long book, and it's a marvelous one. Even when he's being totally wrong, pig-headed, he's writing marvelously about everything, and of course is worth every sentence. But the critical idea in Stendhal is the Salzburg image. This has to do with a phenomenon which he observed in the salt mines at Salzburg. If you put a branch or something like that in the salt mines, and they're still doing it, and leave it there a while, it will collect crystals and take it out. And it'll look like, you know, the trees do when there's been a snowstorm and everything is covered and clinging. And it'll be just transformed. You won't be able to see the limbs and anything. All by these crystallizations gathering together. Almost like magnets work on steel shavings. Now that's the critical image which he uses. Love is indeed the focus of one soul on another with such force that it produces this phenomenon of crystallization. We can see, indeed, the beloved, who is now a stick that's been thrown into a salt mine, you understand, suddenly growing, you see, all these crystallizations shimmering and becoming this beautiful object due to this phenomenon. Certainly, love is now a feeling, basically, not a desire. Plato's theory is a conative one. That is to say, it has to do with drives of movement, just as Freud's does. Whereas Stendhal's is typical of the age of sentiment, I think, and introducing romantic love and so on. Now, there are four kinds of love, he points out, but only one is the real kind. Right? So we have a distinction between a kind of descriptive analysis and then a... Now, one is the real kind, meaning not that it is the one we ought to do, it's just the real love. It's not. The others are just pseudo-love or imitations. And the first, the passion love, is the most important. I'll talk about that. Sympathy love is the mutual adjustment. It's people who are married for a long time, and we say they're happy. Right? It's the mutual adjustment of people to one another for their joint comfort. You might indeed get married out of sympathy love. This would be, in a sense, philia. That is, here's somebody you really like, you get along well, and in fact, that you're not in love is much more comfortable than being in love. Because if you're in love, then there's all these messes, you see. This is the kind of love that can tolerate infidelity quite nicely. Both are unfaithful. What's the French system? And so on. You have this where everybody then is well adjusted and used to it, and they're really concerned with one another's welfare and so forth over a long period of time. But there's no passion. This, of course, to Stendhal, is bourgeois love, the worst sort. Then there's sensual love or lust. And Stendhal says, you know, the kind we have it when we're 16. Here comes a pretty milkmaid off into the woods and so forth and so on. That kind of, indeed, what would be desirous love, eros, sensuality. And again, this is not... this is not passionate. It doesn't have the right feeling. This is just sex. Then there's vanity love. Now, the section in Stendhal on what he calls vanity love is brilliant. It's because he was a very acute observer of the social scene. And he knew that most sort of choices of love object were, of course, based not on a presupposition that people would live well together in this sort of sentimental or sympathy sort of way, because you didn't know that yet, but rather that this person, let's suppose it's a woman, is beautiful and will be a marvelous decoration to your taste. It is the kind, for those of you who know the portrait of a lady that Gilbert Osmond has for Isabel Archer, he says she is attached, or James says she will be attached to him like a deer park to the estate. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's a possession. Or women who Ortega excoriates because he has seen too many Spanish women, because they're always marrying what is called an interesting man. An interesting man means a rich boor, or an individual who is famous. The trouble with women, Ortega says, and he has a long list of troubles, the trouble is that they don't marry bodies. They're only after what they call mind, which they really mean power. Power of some sort, some grandeur. So just as women, you see, are after power, and thus ugly men who are famous can still have a hot sex life, is the same obverse of men who, of course, are the powerful men who want the pretty women and the adornment and so forth of that kind of thing. Right, so that's out for him. So we come to passion love. The course of love is arranged almost as if he had been reading Descartes, you know, first, second, third, fourth. Right? And we can go through it very rapidly, as he does. First, there is something Ortega talks about a lot. He calls it admiration. Plato called it beauty. That is, the immediate physical beauty. It's necessary, as Ortega says, often because something has to cause somebody to stand out in the crowd. Now, it may be fame. Everybody's pointing, Carlos Fuentes. Right? And, of course, you don't have to have him pointed out. He just is. But nevertheless, somebody points him out and says, there he is. And so there's the halo of the great man, and he's attracted. So something has to, and usually it is, in the ordinary run of events, some sort of physical thing. what it might be, of course, aptness in conversation or a love of tennis that you share or any number of other things that does this. But for Stendhal, of course, it's this initial admiration. It occupies increasingly your attention and you begin to single out and focus sharply on the individual. Details and so on of behavior and physical bearing and the rest. Now that leads immediately to the stage of sensuality, the 16-year-old stage. What physical pleasure it would be to get the favors of, that sort of thing. So you begin to see this person and then begin to dream about how nice it would be to be intimate with them. Not just simply at the physical level, but at the level of exchange of secrets, of the soul and all the rest. Then there is the third stage, hope, which is then now the hope that indeed maybe she or he will in fact grant the last and ultimate, as Stendhal always put in always everybody in the 18th century, the ultimate favor. This hope is the final thing. If there is no hope, then, you know, it's you're standing on the street and there's Marilyn Monroe going into the theater and you say, oh, and wouldn't it be nice? It would, but it isn't going to happen. No hope, right? Then there's no love, you see, right? According to him. But at once the moment, suppose, you know, she turns like everybody tended to imagine or believe that Mae West did and says, why don't you come up and see me sometime? Then hope immediately. Right? And as soon as the hope then emerges, then the distance between that and the love is very quick. Love is born. And we have the first stage of what he calls crystallization. Now, crystallization is a projection of perfections upon the beloved object, person. These perfections. They don't have them, but they must have a ground for them, just as the branch has to be there in the way to collect those. There is a connection between what is now happening. Total falsification is not total. There is a ground. Nevertheless, an enormous overestimation of the beloved object and a projection of perfections. And indeed, each individual, and of course, we have to remember that Stendhal is basically writing this book about and for men. And he's thinking about men loving women, basically. All right, now he's saying, all right, what man does is carry around these dreams of perfection, which he doesn't find in himself. And then he sees someone who is, in fact, the sort of person who might bear them. And then the projection occurs. First stage of crystallization. Now you have this glittering figure. And you look at this glittering, glorious figure. And you, of course, are not worthy of such a great and glorious person. Doubt, next stage. Then you start your courtship. No, you've done the wrong thing. You were too impetuous. No, you weren't impetuous enough. You did say this and you should have said that, and so on. And Stendhal, of course, in his novels and his diaries, who was busy carrying out this kind of thing, it is an autobiographical account. That's what's so bad about these theories, if you care to keep your privacy. He's giving an account of his own psychology very, very clearly. And Stendhal then will feel unworthy, not a chance. But then the second crystallization, she loves me, she loves me not, she loves me, and so on, right, takes place over and over. The second stage is that it really does look, she does love me after all. Now, notice that in Stendhal, it's not basically important that she go to bed with you. I mean, that doesn't prove she loves you. What Stendhal wants is love in return. And what does that mean? That means crystallization back. And now we come to the core of this theory, which I'm now carrying one step further than Stendhal does because I think it exposes the theory. Maybe the correct one, but Stendhal didn't quite realize, of course, in his account. He knew it was a fiction he was describing. He knew that people were falling in love with appearances, their own creations, and that therefore love could not last. It is, of course, a part of the intensity that you involve here, that you think that it is forever, and that the individual, indeed it would be, because those perfections are so, how could it be otherwise? But later, of course, just as you shake that branch, knock it on a table, it shatters, the reality appears, something is going to happen to destroy it. But the main reason, why would we want to go about making these projections? The aim is to get a perfection, to realize perfections in you, right? To fall in love with you. There is your thing. What you do is create something that's perfect, which has the great wit to be in love with you. That reaction now is very important to Stendhal's theory, I think. So, of course, love is a fiction of the ideal. Ideals which cannot be realized normally. Reality can't be loved. Only this dream that is conferred. Men like to, because they're the ones with ideals. Women don't have ideals. They have practical concerns and how to get ahead and how to do this and that, but no ideals. men love to idealize, and women love to be idealized. They just love to stand there and be decorated, sequined by devotion. And indeed, they go around. They are, in fact, easily trapped by just that devotion. Even if they didn't like you to start with, it must be something good about you if you think so well of me, good eye. So then pretty soon you can succeed. The consummation, which is regularly rendered by Stendhal as the debacle, is 9 times out of 10 a catastrophe. In Stendhal's particular case, over and over again he found himself impotent in front of the ultimate. Why, of course, it should be, because this is perfection. So doubt, at the last moment, you see, ruins everything. Well, that's, again, much more, but I'm going. Rilke, very quickly, his theory is not as complex in one sense. It's poetically quite profound, but in terms of structure, it is truncated. For Rilke, the critical thing is the problem of being loved. And that determines his idea of what love ought to be. And he's really concerned he's concerned both with what love is, as he perceives it, and then what love ought to be, which is something else. And over in his poetry, he is recommending a certain kind of love. It is much less theoretical than, in that sense, than the other. Rilke was what Ortega would call a true Don Juan. Ortega says, Don Juans do not pursue women. Women pursue Don Juans. The true Don Juan is a male flirt, a coquette. Reverses traditional roles. Now, I'm quoting Ortega's views. He's the inaccessible. Women are falling in love with him, but he's always out of reach. That psychologically, according to Ortega, the Don Juan who pursues everybody is impossible psychologically to be successful. And Rilke was, of course, all his life pursued by women. Women fell in love with him with an incredible frequency, and indeed forever. Not perhaps was he as fortunate as Chateaubriand, who was one of the famous, most famous of all lovers, or Casanova, who was perhaps the most accomplished of all. In the sense that the women who loved him, you know, permanently, no matter what happened. That's at least what he says. But Rilke did have this tendency. He was not, again, a handsome person at all, but he projected a figure of great romanticism, of great spirituality. He was the poet. And indeed, what exactly attracted women was that spirituality, that total devotion to poetry, that absolute dedication. And the fact, of course, that he would write in there, he would visit you for a weekend. You invited him. He was a social parasite, of course. He had, like Socrates and others, to live on the benevolence of titled women. He had not much money himself and hardly any place to live, and he moved around all the time, being a professional guest. And this was very tiring on him because, of course, he wanted to write poetry. And frequently he would get, of course, a chateau sort of lent to him. He was a house sitter, you know. He sat in people's apartments while they were away. They left the servants, of course. Now, while that sort of process is happening in Rilke's life, he is also writing a little in their book, you know. He gives them a present. He writes a poem. It's incredible, beautiful, you know. And after you've had a few of those things written to you, you're enslaved. And indeed, he carried on correspondence with these people, and this correspondence was sensuous. It was lush. It was beautiful. It was open, intimate, and of course, through that, the people were all the more. And there were several women who loved him for years, never having met him. And indeed, on occasion, and finally, there was the meeting. And so, in one case, Nora Weidenbrook, they have their meeting. It goes well. He goes back to his flat. And he writes a note to her that is the famous poem that contains the great lines about I've wandered here, a stranger in a world of strangers, and now you take me home. Oh yes, she says. So of course he has drawn them all, right, in that sense, and they love him, and they say they love him. They want him. But now Rilke, of course, realized, what do they want him to be now that they want him? They want him to wash diapers. They want him to make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. They want him to be a husband and a father. Right? You, the great poet, I love you, your spirituality, and let's now live together in a hovel. And indeed, that was what his first marriage was like, on a rebound from someone who loved him, Lou Andreas Salome, and who therefore would not marry him, had the sense. She really valued his talent. She had the kind of love for Rilke. Rilke proclaimed to be the proper sort. She valued his talent, so she did not want to make him not a poet. So he is aware then that what, or he thinks, this is his view, that when people love you, although they are attracted by these ideal things, when they get you, that isn't what they want, and nor is that the way you will be able to live. So Rilke became very, very skittish. He felt that love, as ordinarily practiced, was therefore disastrous, destructive, engulfing. And the model, of course, he had, if we apply Freudian terminology, was his own mother, whose love was sentimental, cheap, vain, and hypocritical, both for people and for, let's say, the church, where she pretended to be a very devout, well, she was self-deluded, but it was so cheap, and Rilke saw this. See. So his notion, then, a model, was a mother who did indeed play the game of loving a lot, but which was all false. So he's very suspicious on those grounds, too. But Rilke now proposes a different theory out of and in reaction to this condition, which I would like to suggest is the condition of anybody of any sex who wants to do anything important. Because just that very desire is going to be very attractive. It is attractive. And it will attract people who will want you to be in a situation where you can't do what you were attracted to do. It is the big game hunter. Oh, I love the lion. Put him in a cage. So what Rilke is responding to is that kind of condition. But it's that particular kind of love, of course, which he sees as the love everywhere that he's worried about. Therefore, of course, it is far better to love than be loved. Being loved is a real pain. And it is a pain because immediately, you see, all of us have had this experience to some degree, and I suppose famous people have it enormously. They come up to you and they say, oh, Mr. Gass, I just love your, I think it's short stories, or are you a poet? Your short stories, I just love them. And then they have a manuscript behind their back, of course. And since they love your work, they want you to spend your time reading theirs. So you see that kind of problem all the time. No one comes up and says, I love your work, I'm going to send you to Capri for 3 years. A few people do, but it's not, I've heard of it. Rilke had a theory of non-possessive love, and it has been highly ridiculed, and I think wrongly. Rilke's theory is really a naive version of Kantianism. What Rilke is saying is that to love someone is to value them as an end in themselves. And if you value somebody as an end in themselves, you value their freedom. A key term in Kant. It's a non-coercive love. It's a love which is saying, I do not in any way bind you by my feelings. And to display those feelings in such a way that the person is not bound by them. Because it's, of course, usually, oh, don't mind me, don't be bound by my feelings, do what you like. We've heard that, where it's all lies, of course. But to present your feelings in such a way that this is the case. So for Rilke, the non-possessive love is a love which helps that person realize their ends. And in their way, not, oh, you want to realize those ends? Well, let me do it for you. Not that sort of thing. Which preserves the freedom of the individual to realize themselves. And I think that's a very Kantian notion. It's just that Rilke, of course, does not arrive at it in this way. He arrives at it overly personally, without theoretical background, and so on. But it leads, of course, also, and this is the next and final thing about Rilke's theory, to great poetry. The elegies are full, of course, of expressions of this love, where he says to two lovers who are in holding one another in the sense to merge, see, to swallow one another up in this kind of theory that he dislikes. He says, throw the emptiness out of your arms, because that's what you have a hold of. To broaden the spaces we breathe. And then he says, maybe the birds will feel the extra air and fly more magnificently. So get rid of all of that. Magnificent poetry. Well, what he's saying, of course, is that that's what love does. It gives you magnificent poetry. As long as you, you know, do it by letter, by post, by distance, in language. So, of course, the ultimate gift to the people whom Rilke loved most and who loved him most. When Rilke finally, in his great spiritual and creative storm, produced the elegies and the sonnets in a few days or a few weeks, he made a copy and sent it to the woman who had supported him so marvelously for so long in the right way. He gave it as a gift. This is the product. This is what you have given to me and I give to you. An exchange, in short, of someone who has made possible in the one person an achievement which then they are able to give as fruit, see, to the other person. Now, mutual love, then, realizes the capacities in both, and what you get back as a reward is the accomplishments of one another in this kind of scheme. Okay, lastly, oh boy, lastly, Freud, in very quickly, and I'll go to the board for this song, very quickly, as you know, Freud Freud had a view that involves the notion of an id, which is the source of desire, in this sense is a broad eros, a universal eros, an ego, which is